recruited by ISIS, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman.
They're normal, everyday kids that get caught up in something, make mistakes, don't realize the choices they're making. They're not all evil like what we see in the media. They're kids having emotional struggles.
Western kids lured by ISIS. Two stories for you today with very different outcomes. Also, plans to provide free internet access in India meet with fierce opposition. And a Korean fashion model finds out that size really does matter.
When I was in LA, I was too skinny to do plus size modeling. But in Korea, I'm just a fat woman. Yeah.
All that and an airport welcome that might even take the edge off a weather delay and a middle seat. It's The World. Today on the show, we're going to try to get our heads around a difficult idea. What leads a young person living what seems to be a normal everyday life in the West to join an extremist group? And what can you do to bring them back? We'll hear from a Canadian woman whose son left home to enlist with ISIS. But first, the BBC talked with one young British woman who was recently contacted by ISIS recruiters. She preferred not to use her name, but she did talk about what first got her interested. It was the news about three teenage girls, gifted students in East London, who slipped away in February to join ISIS.
I guess that sparked the sort of the curiosity. Why are they going? I was really curious about the whole issue of it, really. And I didn't start off with the intention of, yeah, I'm going to go there, definitely. Let me just think about it for a little bit. Like, you know, I was on Twitter, usually. And, yeah, I guess I went into it like that. And then, obviously, my Snapchat must have been in my Twitter bio. And they contacted me on that. And it wasn't really as cliche as people think it was. It wasn't a sort of, yeah, hey, come join us type thing. It was more of a, hey, sister, how are you doing? You know, are you well? You know, mashallah, all these things. And it's like a conversation with your friend. It's like a normal thing. And you start to think, oh, maybe it is normal. It's one of those things where if you talk to someone every day for weeks, you know, you're going to build a relationship with them. You're going to care for them, even if they don't care for you. And then, you know, the questions started dropping, the little, maybe I would be like, oh, so are you married or something over there? And they'll be like, oh, yeah, but it's okay. You know, they care about your opinion over here. You know, it's not like how it is back in the UK where, you know, people don't like you and people are shunning you just because you're Muslim. And it was glorified, I guess. It was made to seem like it was this promised land and everything's perfect there and your whole life's problems will go away. I sort of sat down and thought about it. I was like, wait, but, you know, if I go over there, then what about football, really? I guess if I have three kids and a husband, am I really going to be able to continue living my passion? And the thing about this team is, like, it's a family, really. Everyone's together. You have somewhere where you are accepted and where everyone does love you. And once you have a place to go like this, then you won't even be brought to think about that kind of thing.
The place to go the young woman is talking about is the community around her local soccer team. She now works with the Unity of Faiths Foundation, a group that fights radicalization through soccer. Christiane Boudreau co-founded another kind of group that works to counter extremism. It's called Mothers for Life, and it's a network for parents like her who've lost their sons and daughters to radical groups. Boudreau's son Damien died fighting with ISIS in Syria last year. We've spoken to her before about it. She's reached out to other parents, including a British woman who'd been optimistic that her son might leave ISIS and come home from Syria.
The whole group had high hopes that we would see him again. The biggest thing with any of these parents that we meet is that's our chance to relive and have that hope and keep that hope that they'll come back and turn their life around and that the family won't have to go through what we've all been through.
What happened to this young man?
There was no sign. She didn't know what was happening. Woke up one morning, he was gone. She thought he was gone to work. And later on in the day, found out that he'd been at the airport getting on an airplane to Turkey to travel. 2 months later is when she first heard from him, and that's when we found out where he was, what he was doing, who he was with, and they continued to communicate. But unfortunately, there was no way to convince him to turn around and come back, and he was killed in November.
It's a very tough situation. And I understand that this mother, this British mother, she has not gone public yet. Where does she turn for support?
The only support she does have is within our group. Fortunately, one of the other parents was close enough to be able to make the flight to be there with her when she received the news and try to support her. But there aren't any other associations, groups, foundations where families can get that support. They don't look at our situations as being sympathetic. They unfortunately look at our children as monsters, and they're not. They're normal, everyday kids that get caught up in something, make mistakes, don't realize the choices they're making. They're not all evil like what we see in the media. They're kids having emotional struggles, and some of them just feel that they're doing the right thing to protect the people of Syria from Bashar al-Assad.
When I read about these cases of young men and women joining extremist groups from a distance, it sounds a lot like what we in another age might have called brainwashing, like joining a cult. Is that how you see it?
It's quite similar in a lot of ways. And there's no set profile that you can tell who's going to be the next person to get drawn in. And that's the hardest part. Everybody's looking for a simple answer in a box. Kids come from all types of family backgrounds. Some of them are very, very well educated, just like in cults. We saw the same. But people looking for that structure, looking for that simplified life, looking for something that makes sense in our complex world where everybody has their own strong sense of community.
Are you finding that the process of de-radicalization is similar to deprogramming somebody who's been brainwashed? I know you've done a lot of research on this and are involved with groups that are trying to de-radicalize youth. Is it a similar process?
It is a similar process. We look at disengagement first to get them disconnected, and they still could have radical beliefs. And then we need to work with them to try to reintegrate them and find a positive path again. The biggest thing is trying to intercept as early as possible so they're not traveling, they're not getting deep into the throes of this. Once they start going down that path, it's very difficult to get out. Groups like ISIS don't let you leave anymore. They'd rather execute you as a spy.
Christiane, you and your other son, Luke, are in the process of moving to France outside of Toulouse in just a few days. Given the ISIS attacks in Paris in November, I would have thought you'd want to steer clear of France.
Quite honestly, we're moving to a small town with my parents as support, emotional support. And when you look at the size of the cities, that's where things happen. Plus, the government's moving much closer to trying to find solutions, trying to push solutions, and much more open to working with the parents there to put solutions in place. They're looking at opening 2 DRAD centers. There's potential of us opening a mother's school. There's a lot more opportunity to help families there right now and get something going in a stronghold to set an example.
Is your move to France also to simply be in a place that has more of a community of parents who have gone through the same thing you have?
Definitely. There are a lot more parents that have come open to one another, come together, working together, supporting each other. Whereas in North America, very much, there's still a stigma. Everybody's holding back. They're afraid to speak out. They're afraid to reach out for help. And with our groups in Europe, they're much more open to the concept. So it's easier to gather a stronger network and to be there for one another. It's too difficult to do it by yourself. The emotions are strong. We can't understand it. There's so many gaps and questions left unanswered.
Christiane Boudreau works with Mothers for Life, a network for parents coping with jihadist radicalization in their own families. Her son Damien died fighting with ISIS in Syria last year. Thank you very much, Christiane.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a big turn here. Scientists in Ireland have recently made some remarkable discoveries about Irish history, and they've done it by analyzing the DNA of 4 ancient skeletons. The first headline is that Ireland's first farmers originated in the Middle East. The second headline is that all those stone rings and tombs that we associate with Ireland have nothing to do with the Celts. Here to explain all this is our history guy, Chris Wolfe. Chris, let's start with that first headline. Ireland's first people were from the Middle East?
Well, not the first people, but the first farmers, for sure. We know this from the DNA of a woman who lived about 5,200 years ago and is buried near one of those ancient rings, a place called Ballynahatty in Northern Ireland. And her closest modern relatives actually live in Sardinia in the Mediterranean, a genetic type almost unknown in modern Ireland. So let's just call her Maria for now.
So what do we know about Maria?
So her world was the Stone Age. That means all her tools and implements were natural products like stone and wood and what have you. And she was a farmer, meaning she didn't rely on hunting and gathering for her food. But as I said, the interesting thing is that she has most in common genetically with the people of Sardinia. Her DNA indicates she has a Mediterranean face, probably brown eyes, dark hair. And the ancestors of this group definitely have been traced to the Middle East. They probably migrated to Ireland over the centuries along a kind of a maritime route via Spain, since there's some, you know, genetic markers from Spain as well that show some links. You know, increasingly scientists are finding these Neolithic farmers all over Europe, including Ötzi, the Iceman, who was found in the Alps a few years ago.
Wow. So she was found buried near one of those ancient stone monuments. Was it her people who built them?
Definitely. They were constructed at around exactly this time frame, around 5,000 years ago, give or take, which is about 1,000 years before the arrival of this next group of people that we're going to talk about.
And who are these newcomers?
For this group, the scientists got the DNA from three gentlemen buried on the island of Rathlin, just off the coast of Northern Ireland. And it's long been known that these guys had a completely different technology. These are Bronze Age guys. It means they've discovered metalwork. So their tools and weapons are metal, bronze, initially. But what's now been established is that these guys also genetically very, very different, which means basically that a whole new population moved in and displaced and replaced Maria's people.
But wouldn't they have intermarried and intermixed?
Possibly, but not to an extent that was genetically or demographically significant. So this kind of indicates that at some point her people just lost out to this new and very different population.
So where do the Celts come into all this? Are they the Bronze Age farmers that they've just examined?
Well, we don't have any evidence about what language any of these people spoke, either Maria, the Mediterranean-looking lady, or these new blue-eyed newcomers with the metalworking skills. But interestingly, they have a very close genetic affinity with the modern people of Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. So as the scientists on the project say, this kind of invites the possibility that maybe the language was introduced around this time as well.
And where did these farmers come from, the Bronze Age farmers?
You'll never guess.
Where?
Genetically, they originate in the steppes of what's now Ukraine and Russia and migrated all across Europe, displacing and replacing these Neolithic people pretty much wherever they went, except for places like Sardinia. For some reason, they just left Sardinia alone. So those Sardinians are still genetically the purest, if that's the right word, form of those ancient Neolithic farmers.
So I assume subsequently there have been other migrations into what's now Ireland today.
Right. I mean, there's a very close affinity to the modern Irish people, but there are other dilutions, and particularly the English. The English have a very different kind of Germanic kind of genetic set of markers. So obviously some dilution has been occurring over the centuries.
Amazing story. The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Coming up later in the show, a supernatural experience, the setting, a Victorian house in northern England.
One night, and it's the middle of summer, it was so hot that I was sleeping on top of the bed, not under the sheets, and I suddenly woke up bolt upright, and all the lights were on. The radio was on, and it was so cold in the room that I could see my breath in the air. It was really strange.
Then, well, let's just say it's a tale with a spooky backstory. Oh, yeah, and fans of the PBS show Sherlock might just recognize that voice later on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. Our next story is about a Korean woman with a lot of determination. Kim Ji-young decided to get into modeling, even though she didn't see anyone else in the Korean fashion industry who looked like her. She's what's known as plus size, though Korea doesn't really have plus size models. Jason Strother in Seoul tells us how Kim broke that barrier.
Kim Ji-young struts down the runway dressed in a black corset and a leather skirt. She got her break in modeling after sending her photos to LA's 2010 Full Figure Fashion Week. Kim is 5'5", 154 pounds. That ranks her as curvy in the U.S., but a lot bigger than the average 20-something woman in South Korea.
When I was in L.A., I was too skinny to do plus-size modeling. But in Korea, I'm just a fat woman, yeah.
And in plastic surgery crazy Korea, there's also a lot of pressure for women to be skinny. Kim says Korean women, like her, have a hard time finding clothes that fit them. Anything above an American size 6 is considered plus size here. She says she's a size 8.
I'm kind of alien in Korea. People who plus size in Korea, they are not interested in a social life. They don't go to the shopping.
They don't want people staring at them.
Yeah.
And everyone constantly reminds them how big they are, she says.
My mother always said to me, you are so fat, you have to lose your weight. And my friends, when I met my friends and they said, you're fat or lose your weight.
Kim says at first her parents didn't want her to get into modeling, but now they're proud of what she's accomplished. In addition to L.A., she's done runway shows in Miami and the Caribbean. Kim's been a finalist in photo contests for Benetton and American Apparel, but still, no Korean fashion shows or magazines have given her work. So she started her own magazine that features plus-size models.
Yeah, I just want to make a job for me.
I went with Kim to a printing house as copies of her magazine came off the presses. It's called 66-100, the maximum sizes in centimeters, respectively, for women's and men's clothing sold in Korean retail shops. Kim is an 88. On the cover, Kim is clutching a chunk of fried pig's feet with her manicured fingertips. The picture goes with the feature article, Innocent Pleasure. Kim writes, you shouldn't feel guilty for eating what you like. She also says you shouldn't feel ashamed of what you look like. 66-100's motto is, no matter what, you are beautiful. And her magazine has inspired other women here to give modeling a shot. 23-year-old Lee Hyun-kyung poses for 66-100's online clothing shop. She wears a Korean size 99. A year ago, Lee won the magazine's makeover contest and says modeling changed her life.
I was afraid to have my picture taken. Compared to other people, I look bigger. I always look sad in pictures. I thought I was ugly. Now my friends and family say I seem so much happier, and they say they never knew how pretty I was.
Kim Ji-young has many supporters for her magazine, but there are still plenty of haters, and the harshest remarks appear online.
That comment, I'm really upset because it makes hurt other people who support me or other people who are plus size.
But Kim says she thinks she's taken away the power of those online insults.
Yeah, I captured a whole comments and printed in our this issue. So you can find it. Yeah, they couldn't hurt me anymore.
For the World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
You can see photos of Korea's first plus-size model at PRI.org. Now, if I went to Seoul, I'd probably sample the kimchi, just like I'd want to try fresh sushi in Tokyo. But until recently, the cuisine of Okinawa was not on my list, mostly because I don't know much about what's on the menu in Okinawa. The Japanese island is way south of the mainland, so it's off the beaten path. But as Lori Wolliver writes in the latest issue of Saveur, the food of Okinawa is well worth the trip. She first traveled there as part of the TV crew that brings you the cable show Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown. And she says there's reasons most foodies pass over Okinawa.
First of all, it's a three-hour flight from Tokyo, so there's a geographic barrier that makes it less appealing, especially if you've got a limited amount of time and a limited budget. And I also think that the food is so different and it's so not in keeping with people's expectations of what they know of Japan or what they're looking for in Japan, which is a very precise, very accurate, very intricately prepared dishes. It's really more of a polyglot, and it's something that they don't know enough about to want to seek it out.
Well, what is the food like in Okinawa?
Well, it is Japanese in many ways. There's dashi-based broth, there are noodles, but it's a little looser in structure, and there are influences from other parts of the world that you really don't see in mainland Japan. There are influences from the United States, certainly, because of the large military presence there, and there are also influences from China and even places like Portugal because of their long colonial history and the history of trade and occupation in that country.
One thing you mentioned in your article is Goya Champuru, which I'm probably not pronouncing right. It's a signature dish in Okinawa. What is it?
Goya Champuru is a stir fry that always contains Goya, obviously, and then it's cooked in dashi with other ingredients, typically pork, tofu, and eggs. And it's often garnished with bonito flakes, which is a shaved, dried tuna flake.
Sounds pretty good.
It's quite hearty. It's a real comfort food. It's delicious. I ate a lot of it when I was in Okinawa.
I get a certain vibe when I read your article, and it sounds like Okinawa's kind of, it feels like a big beach island, you know, kind of laid back. Am I getting that right?
Yes, absolutely. It has more in common with Southern California or Hawaii than the rest of mainland Japan. There's just a slower pace. People still, you know, take pride in the way they look, the way they dress, the way their food looks and tastes. But it's dialed down several notches from what one might experience going to mainland Japan.
And another really interesting fact about Okinawa is longevity. A lot of centenarians there. Does that have something to do with the diet?
Traditionally, yes. There's been quite a bit written about the Okinawa diet, the wonders of the Okinawa diet, which was traditionally very plant-based and extremely local. Just, you know, what you grow or what your neighbors grow is what you eat. A lot of root vegetables, a lot of leafy greens, and pork is definitely part of that, but it was used traditionally more as a seasoning or as just a, you know, small piece of pork that might flavor a broth that's then used to cook vegetables and noodles. And that was really a function of poverty more than anything else. People just didn't have the means to have big pieces of meat on the plate. Now things have changed. People have a little more money. The American military presence has been a steady one for the past 50 or 60 years. And that has brought in a different type of diet, more meat, more fast food, more processed foods. And that unfortunately has had a detrimental effect on the longevity of the Okinawa people.
Lori Willever is a freelance food writer whose article about food in Okinawa is in the current issue of Sever. Thanks so much, Lori.
Thank you.
If you want that recipe for a Goya Champuru, we have it at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Still to come, celebrating an Ebola milestone in Guinea and nailing the local accent in Liberia.
I'm going to the Yiddish theater, listening to a play down there, and then I'm going to have some dinner with a friend. So it's sort of like that.
Plus, a supernatural experience Sherlock fans won't want to miss here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. As we sprint to the end of this year, we want to remember a story that was huge in the first half of 2015. I'm talking about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa that ravaged Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. The World Health Organization has declared that as of yesterday, Guinea, where the epidemic began, is finally free of Ebola transmission. We're going to check in with friend of the show, Sherry Fink. She's a reporter with the New York Times. Sherry, first explain to us what the WHO is saying about Ebola in Guinea.
They are saying that for the very first time since Ebola was thought to have originated in a young child who probably caught it from the animal kingdom in a small village in Guinea 2 years ago, finally, that country has no more cases of Ebola, hasn't had cases for 42 days, which is 2 full incubation cycles of the virus, and therefore the WHO can now declare that Ebola virus transmission has stopped.
And remind us what the situation is in Liberia and Sierra Leone.
Sierra Leone has also reached this milestone. Liberia reached it first, but interestingly has had 2 times where Ebola has popped back up, once in one woman, another time in 3 members of a family last month. And so what scientists now know, just this mystery of Ebola, the mysteries keep unfolding, is that in very rare cases, Ebola can likely be transmitted from survivors who may harbor the virus for a certain amount of time in certain body fluids, such as in the testes. It can actually be a sexually transmitted disease in very rare cases. So because of that, what the WHO is saying is that for 3 months now, following this declaration in Guinea, that they will have a period of heightened surveillance. So they'll be on the lookout for any sporadic cases so that they can quickly respond to them.
Have you heard about how people are receiving the news in Guinea? I mean, do they remain skeptical or are they sort of ready to move on?
Well, yeah, I've been working with a reporter there. We worked on a story together yesterday as this momentous day came there, and it was a mixture. So you had people who were dancing. My colleague there said just some of the Ebola response workers who've seen so much death and who've worked so, so hard for 2 years, they were literally dancing. It's been their dream to reach this day. There were others, like some survivors. What we found out is that survivors of Ebola don't just walk away. A lot of them do end up having health problems. So this is a real priority, is to not abandon these people. They have health needs. Some of them have severe eye problems that can be treated very effectively, very cheaply. But if they don't get that treatment, they could lose their vision. They may have psychological issues from all that they saw and suffered and the stigma that remains. So they were taking this day as a day to remember family members who had died. On the other hand, there are a lot of people coming in to celebrate. Today is a day of celebration in Guinea for the end of Ebola. There's a big concert happening in the capital. So a real variety of responses on this momentous day.
Guinea really suffered terribly from Ebola. About 2,500 victims died. 6,200 children have been left orphaned. I imagine that the NGOs are kind of going to pack up, but is anything in place to care for the sort of survivors and then those who are orphaned?
I was speaking with the head of UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, in Guinea by phone yesterday, and he really made this point that we absolutely can't pack up, we can't abandon these children, that there are many, many needs going forward. One of the things that I think the world has realized from this outbreak and the way it got so out of control was that these countries have real needs in terms of healthcare systems, in terms of surveillance for infectious diseases. You know, the next big outbreak could be something else that could emerge there and spread around the world. So I think I've been hearing a lot of at least lip service paid to, we're not packing up, we're going to maintain a commitment. What history shows us is that after a big calamity, there are often a lot of promises made and they don't always get followed through on. So I think that's something that we journalists will need to keep our eyes on in the coming months ahead.
Sherry, this was a very personal story for you. You visited these countries. You did some amazing reporting. And so you experienced this sort of devastation up close. What was your own reaction to hearing that Guinea has been declared free of Ebola transmission?
Well, gosh, it is really emotional, especially thinking about all of the heroic work that's gone on in the communities and the survivors and their just tenacious will to get through this awful, awful disease. So, yeah, I'm feeling good and seeing some of the pictures of the big smiles on people's faces. And I remember sitting back in February, just people just talking and dreaming about this day and what they would do once Ebola was gone.
Sherry Fink is a reporter with The New York Times. Thanks, Sherry, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The week between Christmas and New Year's. Ah, yes, 'tis the season of blockbuster movie releases. One of the big budget films released this holiday season is the Will Smith film Concussion. The film tells the story of Nigerian Dr. Bennett Omalu and how he raised alarm bells about the effects of head injuries in the NFL. Here's a clip from the trailer.
When I was a boy, heaven was here, and America was here. You could be anything. Do anything. I am the wrong person to have discovered this.
That's American actor Will Smith playing the role of the Nigerian doctor. Do you think he sounds Nigerian? Well, Nigerians don't. Here's Nigerian comedian and satirist L. Nathan John on a YouTube video spoofing Smith.
Haters will say he does not sound Nigerian at all. But I say he sounds like a Nigerian with a concussion.
Ouch. And he's not the only one. Will Smith hasn't been getting any Twitter love from Nigerians who've heard his version of their accent. Beth McGuire teaches acting at Yale University and is the author of the new book, African Accents, a Workbook for Actors. Beth McGuire, how tough is it to do a Nigerian accent?
Well, first of all, you have to determine what ethnic group or what tribe you're working from. I've taught three different Nigerian accents, Yoruba, Igbo, and Ibibio. And each of them was distinct. So if that's the aesthetic of the production, then you go towards whatever that particular tribal accent is.
Just by listening to the clip of Will Smith, can you tell what he was trying for? Which Nigerian accent?
I'm not sure. I think he's trying really hard, but it's indistinct to me. I'm just not sure. And I'm not sure how the choice he made helped him with his transformation as character.
How do you train actors to do African accents? Obviously, that's a sort of funny term to use because there's more than 50 countries in Africa. We aren't talking about every African accent, but how do you work with actors? What do you do?
It's not unlike working with any other accent. The challenge has been that there are very few materials out there for African accents, and the bar has been very low, which has spurred me on to write a book about it. Some actors have incredible ears. Some actors really understand how to shift into what I would call vocal posture. And that's learning where the tongue tends to rest, where the jaw tends to rest, where if the lips are active, if they aren't active, they round out, if they round in.
Now, you're American, but you teach African accents and coach actors to perfect an African accent. How do you learn the African accents? You go talk to people from those countries?
You find people who speak it, or you go on this amazing resource called YouTube, and you find interviews with politicians or all different kinds of people, and you listen to them. And one of the big things when, particularly for African accents, you have to really look at which country colonized that African nation. Some of those countries have been colonized by French people. Some of those countries have been colonized by English people. Some of those countries have been colonized by Portuguese, Dutch, English, and French people. So you have a huge mishmash of it. A very interesting accent in Africa is Liberian, which I've been working on for the production of Eclipse that's going to Broadway in February. And that is a very fascinating African accent.
Can you do it for us?
Oh, yeah, sure. I could do Liberian. Let me see. Well, I can't tell you. I'm not so warmed up today, but you know, I could say that this afternoon I'm going downtown. I'm going to the Yiddish Theater, listening to a play down there, and then I'm going to have some dinner with a friend. So it's sort of like that.
And how about, I'm gonna guess.
Did you understand what I said?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. Well, that tells you that I'm not doing an entirely kosher Liberian accent, because what one has to do a lot with accents is you have to cheat them towards whatever audience is listening to you. Because if you listen to somebody who's really riffing in a Liberian accent, you can't understand a word they're saying. It's fantastic. It's really a fantastic accent.
Are there certain movies that you just can't watch because the accents are so bad?
Yes, and I'm not going to tell you what they are.
Come on.
Oh, no. No, I mean, the one thing that I'm not a basher, because I know how difficult it is. And I also know that, and this is a big deal, until producers really, until they decide that accents and dialects are important, that you need somebody on set and you need actors prepped with it, they're just not going to be good. The biggest problem is that they're not going to be consistent, which is what I hear a lot. You know, the actor is hustling around trying to get somebody to coach them, and I've done that a lot, but everybody else in the movie is not being coached, or three other people in the movie are not being coached. Even if you don't know that that's happening, there's a sense that the reality is kind of shattered, and you're not able to go in as deep. If the accents are good, you don't notice them. You notice what's going on with the people.
Beth McGuire teaches acting at Yale University, and she's the author of a new book, African Accents, A Workbook for Actors. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you, Carol.
I don't have to tell you how hard it can be to travel this time of year. This week was especially frustrating with ice storms, weather delays, and canceled flights. But even on a regular day, getting through airport security seems to take forever. But there's one man at the airport in Toronto who's trying to make air travel almost pleasant. Nima Roshania of WHYY has his story.
Oh, holy night, have a nice day. Put away your passport, all you need is your boarding pass. Put a smile on your face, no, that's all you need now.
In Terminal 1 of Toronto's bustling Pearson Airport, Ivan Watson is trying to make it a little less painful to pass through airport security. He spends each of his 8-hour shifts processing check-in luggage and singing to passengers as they trudge through, regaling them with everything from PSAs.
I hope you don't drink and drive this season. Drink, you don't drive, and if you drive, you do not drink.
To songs that might cheer up travel-weary kids.
Diggle, diggle, the cat and the figure, the cow jump over the moon.
That's what first inspired him to sing on the job, when he came across kids in line who wouldn't stop crying.
So I started singing to the kids, and the kids stopped crying and listening to me. And I sing and I sing and I sing. And from that on, I just started to sing to everybody.
Watson says singing was a way of life for him back home in Jamaica. He immigrated to Canada in 1987.
Where I come from, I am a Jamaican. And where I come from is music. Our radio do not stop play 24/7, right back. That is our pleasure.
He's reminded of home, especially during the holiday season, when Canada's usually frigid weather keeps so many people inside.
When I'm there, there's so many of my friends coming around and come to see me and having fun, music playing, everybody playing Christmas carol.
Growing up in Jamaica, he says he was never allowed to pass someone on the street without saying good morning or good evening. Now he sees thousands of strangers pass by every day, but he still makes the effort.
You know what they tell me? I'm the first person to tell them good morning. And they feel good about it. Most of them coming through have so many things on their mind. So you come and you say good morning or whatever. They feel good.
And Watson has no shortage of things to sing about.
You don't want to go on standby, for standby can for tomorrow.
For the world, Nima Roshania, Pearson Airport, Toronto.
So wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed.
Okay, you might want to listen to another kind of music while you're standing in line. So let's dip into our collection of music that we loved in 2015.
Comienzo a sentir la verdad de la realidad, las cosas que me sorprendían. Hoy en día ninguna me deslumbra de verdad. Los fantasmas que intento atrapar se me escabullen en los brazos. Tendría que aceptar mi realidad o pedirle a los astros que tengan piedad. Aquí estoy trabajando, no pierdo la dignidad. Con este hambre voraz que...
This is Femina. They're an all-female trio from Argentina. They don't have much of a profile here in the United States. They haven't been picked up by a major label. The group has produced and released their 2 albums on their own. And while they've been hired to tour in Europe and Mexico, they often give concerts for free back home. That's right, free. They're definitely doing it on a grassroots level. Here's hoping their 3rd album will get them some name recognition here. They're in the midst of recording it now. In the meantime, we discovered their 2nd album, Traspasa, in 2015.
Un amor de eternidades, que así viví. Nuestro amor de eternidades. No quisiera desaparecer antes de mojarme otra vez los pies en la luna. No quisiera desaparecer antes de mojarme otra vez los pies en la luna.
The Argentine trio Femina and their song Buen Viaje. For more of our favorite picks for 2015, head over to PRI.org. We've got the complete list. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. A couple years ago, Facebook announced it wanted to give away free but limited access to the internet. CEO Mark Zuckerberg called it a step toward digital equality, especially in developing countries. That might sound like a nice gift for the holidays, but internet activists in India don't think so. They say limited access goes against the whole idea of a World Wide Web. And they say Facebook's app, Free Basics, will lead to unfair competition. The app only includes services that share data with Facebook. So no Google, no Amazon, no Twitter. Apparently, the Indian government agrees with the critics. This week it banned Free Basics, at least for now, and today so did Egypt. Bhaskaran Rahman is a professor at the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay. He's helping to lead a campaign against Facebook.
See, the term Free Basics, they have chosen it so that, you know, you come across as someone crazy if you want to oppose Free Basics, right? Who wouldn't want Free Basics? Well, that all sounds very nice. But how are you going to do it? You know, there's lots of problems with that.
So practically, if I'm in India and I get Free Basics, I can go online, but only to certain sites?
That's the proposal, yes. The set of sites approved by Facebook, other set of sites, you can get access to free. And that's not right. They shouldn't get to control the price of what services users access. I mean, it's bad enough if an Indian private company gets to control it. If a foreign private company, which is not under jurisdiction of Indian law, you know, that makes the whole thing far worse.
You've started a fight against Facebook by helping write a petition, and dozens of prominent Indians in the tech sector have signed it. What are your demands?
Well, the proposal as it stands, you know, has lots and lots of problems. You can provide free basics in a lot of other ways. So, for example, Facebook can just provide the first 50 or 100 megabytes for their data connection free every month without data going through Facebook servers and them extracting whatever information they want out of it.
Is that sort of the gist of it, that the fact that they're going to use the data, is that the thing that has irked you and others?
Yeah, so that's one of the primary things. And the fact that they're pitching this whole thing as a, as though it's charity for the poor masses kind of thing, that doesn't sit well with me. Apart from that, there is this whole thing about violation of net neutrality, where different services are priced differently. And because of that, the whole idea of fully connected internet falls apart. If you start pricing based on the content of what users access, then there would be unfair competition. And as a result of that, the barrier to entry into the internet, which is currently very low, will go up. And that's something we should not lose.
So in the case of Facebook, couldn't you make the argument that some access to the internet is better than no access to the internet for millions of Indians?
Yes, but that some access that they're providing is not to the internet. It's to a very small subset of websites which Facebook chooses.
Do you feel like Facebook was disguising a marketing campaign as charity?
I certainly think so. You know, in order to provide sustainable internet connectivity for Indian masses or any other community around the world, you need a, you know, economic structure. There needs to be a structure of who pays for what and so on. It cannot be based on charity. Generally, companies don't do charity for charity's sake. I think Facebook underestimated the amount of opposition they will face. And hopefully we will win.
Bhaskaran Raman is a professor at the Indian Institute of Technology in Mumbai. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally today, fans of Benedict Cumberbatch probably know a new episode of Sherlock airs this Friday on PBS. But that's about all we know about the episode, other than it's set in Victoria-era England and it's all about ghosts. Turns out there's a spooky story that inspired the episode. It's from the show's creator, Mark Gatiss. You may know him as the guy who plays Sherlock's brother Mycroft in the series.
Well, I did actually once have a sort of supernatural experience. I was very skeptical because I thought it'll never happen to someone like me because I really wanted to, but it sort of did. I was, many years ago, I was living in Leeds in the north of England, and a friend of mine went on the summer vacation and he let me have his attic room in this big Victorian house for like 3 months. It was a godsend because I was absolutely desperately poor. And it was a big, empty, spooky house. And I'm not prone to fancies, as they say, but it was quite odd. Anyway, it started off fine. But I remember I went away to Wales and I remember coming back and opening the door to this room, and there was such a heavy atmosphere inside the room. It was like 100 people had been in there. And as soon as I opened the door, they'd all jumped out the window. It was like it was a crowded room. It was so weird. I remember sort of taking a step back. It was so strange. And then all sorts of odd little things started to happen. I had a very strong feeling of being watched. And then one night, and it's the middle of summer, it was so hot that I was sleeping on top of the bed, not under the sheets. And I suddenly woke up, bolt upright, and all the lights were on. The radio was on. And it was so cold in the room that I could see my breath in the air. And it was the middle of summer. It was really strange. And I was properly spooked by it. And the next day, I rang my friend up. And obviously, something in my... I didn't say anything. Something in my tone suggested something, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "I didn't sleep very well." And he said, "Have you seen it yet?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I think it might be haunted." And I said, "Yes, I think it might be too." So then that was it. When he came back, we started to do a little investigation and discovered that the room had a bit of a history, and people who'd lived there before, odd things had happened. It was someone who'd lived in the floor below when the room was empty. They used to go up there to study and had to stop because they thought someone was looking at them. All kinds of odd circumstantial things. And then I moved to Bristol, and my friend Roger rang me up one night and he said, "You'll never believe what's happened." And he had a dinner party. And they invited this bloke who people said was slightly psychic. And this bloke had said, "Do you mind if I look around the house?" And without any warning, he'd sort of wandered up to this top of the stairs to this attic room. And he came back down and said to Roger, "Have you had any odd experiences?" And Roger, not wanting to give anything away, sort of said, "Well, sort of, yeah." And this bloke said, "Well, that room at the top in the attic, on the threshold of the door, there was someone waiting, and they're still there."
Mark Gatiss with that creepy story. Sherlock, The Abominable Bride premieres in the U.S. on PBS Friday night. And that's it for us here at The World. I'm Carol Hills. I'm from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.